to the Cinematologist Podcast. I'm Neil Fox, and with me in a Berlin hotel room is...
that sounds really dodgy, but
I think people know us by now.
Okay.
Dario Linares. Hello, Dario.
Hello, Neil. Great to be here.
It is great to be here.
We have a very standard Berlin hotel room that's perfectly serviceable.
It's all you need at a festival, isn't it? You know, you just it's just a place to sleep and hold your bags.
Absolutely. And this is kind of like the changeover mode. We're going to do the proper changeover bit in the middle, but this is our Berlinale extravaganza.
Yeah, very new kind of episode.
Indeed.
Very strange episode that we're both in Germany at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, we've both been to the Berlinale Festival before, but not at the same time.
No, that's right, yeah.
And I suppose the relationship, or definitely mine, and I don't know if you've been to Berlin before, but my relationship with the Berlin Film Festival was when I was working down at Falmouth, even before you came to Falmouth, and me and Kingsley went to came to the festival the first time we took the students there many years ago. It must have been 2012, 2013 or something. And I just fell in love with the city immediately and the festival itself. It was sort of a combination of the two things. But you're over here, you've literally just walked into a hotel with 40 students and got them into their rooms.
Yeah, so since you first came, it's been a tradition.
Yes.
I first came with Falmouth in 2015, and you looked after my dog.
That's true.
You had Bailey while I was away, which is the first time I think I'd have left him with anyone other than my family, so that was a big deal.
Trust, that's what
exactly,
it is.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And look where we are now.
Indeed.
So that was the first time I came with the course, and yeah, and I'm back again with a couple of my colleagues and a load of students. We've just arrived a couple of hours ago. When I first started at Falmouth, I was kind of excited because Berlin was a city that I'd been to quite a lot and loved. I'd never been to the festival. I'd always sort of come at different times, and mostly in the summer actually, and sort of, you know, visiting friends here and kind of spending time here. So it was a good chance because I'd heard that it was just a fun festival, you know, turned a great city into an even greater city if you're a kind of cinephile. So it was such a great time last time.
Well, it's funny because I think it's the market festival, isn't it? If you're in the industry, I think it's where actually the sort of producers or the distributors and the head honchos come and buy movies rather than Cannes and Venice.
Well, it's the first big market of the year.
Yeah.
So it is the place where a lot of the stuff that is kind of going to be at festivals maybe a bit later on, or kind of, you know, was at Sundance, you know, it kicks off the year in Europe, definitely.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff that, you know, a lot of the films haven't got distribution. There's a lot of films in the market that aren't even playing, you know, that are kind of new and trying to get that early boost.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they've got the Panorama 40 anniversary this year, which reflects the sense that I think Berlinale feels that it's the most edgy of the big European festivals in terms of championing films that are not necessarily mainstream.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's definitely a festival that is like the big European festival. Well, not like Cannes, which never changes and doesn't seem in any interest have any interest in changing. But like Berlin and Venice, particularly kind of trying to always think about where do they fit? What kind of festival are they? And it is interesting that they're kind of pushing that stuff and the forum as well, you know, sort of really celebrating the stuff which we will talk about in this episode for a kind of very specific reason. It was good to be able to kind of come back. And what I did was, it's been 4 years, so, and I sort of said to Kingsley, you know, I'd like to go, because I thought that if I was in here, then I could try and get accreditation for the podcast.
Yeah.
So I did. I just sort of applied. We've never really done anything like that before.
No, that's so right. I've looked at it before, but it always seems like it's such a long form. But I mean, was it tough or was it okay?
It wasn't too bad. No. It was, yeah, I mean, I've got no idea. I mean, I haven't got my press pass yet, so I'll find out tomorrow what it looks like.
Okay.
But, I'm in the system.
Yeah, that's good.
They're expecting me.
Yeah.
And it was just writing a letter, really, because we didn't have any coverage. So
no.
I just wrote about what we do, who we've talked to, the kind of the partners that we have, and flagged up sort of what our achievements and hoped that they'd say, and they did. So yeah, that was kind of exciting. And then I said to you, I've got accreditation, I'm going.
And I was like, what? Okay. Yeah, and I was sort of, oh, that's absolutely fantastic. And then it got to kind of like Wednesday last week, and I was just sort of thinking, like, I'd seen some of the messages saying you were going, you're preparing to go. And then, you know, the whole Mark Jenkin Bay thing happened, which is going to be a big, anchoring point of this episode, I think. So obviously, regular listeners will know who Mark Jenkin is, big friend of ours and has been on the podcast regularly. And his feature got into the festival. And I just thought to myself, it was one of those things where, you know, you realise that you were here, we've got accreditation. Mark had his, world premiere of the festival last night, as it were, on the first Saturday. I was like, these things don't come along very often. And I just thought, sod it, I'm going. And it was one of those moments where it's like, I've got too much to do. But you're like, but in 10 years' time, you'll look back and think, well, did I really have too much to do? Shall I just go and live? And because you've got the privilege, you've got the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about money half the time, isn't it? You know, and I've got that privilege. I just thought, I'm going. I'm going to go to the premiere and I'm going to hook up with you. And yeah, it's been a really, really fun weekend.
Great. Well, I suppose that's a good time for us to segue into what you've been up to. So do you want to just let listeners know what the next section will be?
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of the structure of the whole podcast, I think this is a kind of passing of the baton period. So I've been here, as I said, for sort of 2 or 3 days, and I've recorded a couple of short sort of 10-minute summaries of what I've seen and a couple of other, you know, asides about the city and various things. So we've got my day one and day two report, and then we're going to come back and me and Neil are going to discuss my day three viewings, and then we'll preface what Neil's got coming for the rest of the podcast. So yeah, it's going to be an eclectic episode that's going to cover an awful lot in two kind of sections. And so yeah, this is my recordings from the last couple of days on what I've seen and my thoughts on the festival as a whole. First little summary of what I've been doing and watching. So I'm here for 3 days. This is the Friday. It's been a long day. I was strolling through a deserted Islington tube station at 5:30 this morning, and it was incredible to think that by 4:30 the same afternoon I would be sitting in the Kino Internazionale ready for my first screening. And it was gratifying to see that my first cinema of the trip was situated on Karl Marx Alley. So, yeah, all I thought was down with capitalism and up with cinema. Are these two things compatible? I'm not sure. You can be the judge. Just preparing to come, the ticketing for the Berlin Film Festival has always been a kind of abstract proposition, a sort of ruthless Hunger Games for anything that you can get into, really. But I was a little bit more organised this time. I managed to get onto the computer at 9 a.m. in the morning, 4 days in advance. So when the tickets are released, I was there fighting away in the ether, trying to get hold of some stuff, and I managed to get 3 tickets for both days, for the Saturday and the Sunday. So I'm going to be seeing quite a bit, but I didn't have anything for today. But luckily, I managed to get this ticket for Tsai Ming-liang's Rebels of the Neon God, which was showing, as I say, at the Kino International in the afternoon at 4:30. Now, this was part of the Panorama 40 section. So this is a kind of recognition of the 40th anniversary of the Berlinale, and particularly with regards to films that the curators of this section have deemed to have stood the test of time, that continue to be influential, or filmmakers themselves who continue to be influential. And it's kind of celebrating that idea of, particularly I think in the 70s, 80s and 90s, that the Berlinale was seen as a very political film festival and was sort of groundbreaking in the avant-garde and the more cutting-edge films that it championed and its audiences really liked. And I mean, the subtitle for the Panorama 40 section is Cinema with a Long-Term Memory. So, Tsai Ming-liang. Back in the very, very nascent days of the Cinematologist podcast, one of the films that Neil showed back in Falmouth was Goodbye Dragon Inn, which, you know, a kind of incredible piece of cinema, really. And it was kind of exploring some of the issues around the death of cinema and
set entirely within a dilapidated auditorium, and the camera was kind of focusing on what the audience was, the sort of fag end of cinema watching in Taiwan, with these little stories taking place amongst the audience members. And it really kind of assured and subtle yet complex piece of work. And it's interesting, this film was his first feature, and I think it really does have the kind of first feature feel about it, even though it is still a very accomplished piece of work. So I say it has the feel of a first feature because it has a kind of raw energy. I think it focuses on the dissatisfaction of youth and constructs its leads with a kind of air of romanticism, even though they are absolutely, you know, at the bottom of society. It's kind of interesting. So sex and criminality are kind of like two of the central themes of the film, but also there's a real bitter humour to it, a kind of darkness, I think, and a real sense that the leading characters are really sort of stuck in this no man's land. I mean, the way it's shot, the kind of cityscape is very labyrinthine, so you don't get very many establishing shots. Indeed, there's a kind of ending shot, which is kind of a relief because it pulls away and lets you see the city, but it's very interesting how claustrophobic it is. I mean, the basic plot is that a young man lives with his overbearing parents, and he hates going to school, and he has this kind of chance encounter and becomes obsessed with these two low-level street hoodlums who themselves in turn are in a kind of relationship with this young woman. There are sort of plot gaps and editing jumps in it, which I don't think it's kind of deliberately meant to be unsettling, but there are sort of leaps that take place, which is typical of a first feature, but it's really easy to go with it. But the characters all have the sense that they're kind of going nowhere, and this sort of dark gallows humour reflects the fact that the characters feel that they're not in control of their own lives, and all of the narrative points that move the story forward, they're kind of chance moments. So it's kind of like things could have gone in so many different ways. It's just the fact that these chance moments has caused the narrative to drive in the way that it did. The other thing about it is really fascinating, the texture of the movie. It was shot on 35mm, and it really does have that kind of late 80s, early 90s rawness that you often see with low-budget international, although I hate using that phrase, features. But made in 1992, you can certainly see the progression to 2003 when he made Goodbye Dragon Inn. And to be honest with you, I just did a quick look online and saw that I haven't seen any of his other sort of 10 or 12 works that he's done. So I'm definitely going to check them out and try and follow them in terms of the progression, because I think this is a filmmaker that you probably would be able to see the development of his style into him becoming a really accomplished filmmaker that is, you know, extremely highly rated. So that's the only film I've seen today. So this is my first little report. I'm going to be looking at new stuff tomorrow. So I'm going to be watching in the morning. First thing I'm going to see is Kim Longinotto's new film, which is called Shoot the Mafia. So that's early doors. And then I'm seeing a film called Serendipity in the afternoon. And then the big one I'm looking forward to is Mark Jenkins Bay. Of course, Mark, a big friend of the podcast. Please follow us on Instagram and Twitter. You'll see that me and Neil will be going social media mad as we go along in the festival this week. And we hope you enjoy these continued little these little vignettes that we're going to give you. Just an aside, it's, you know, I really do love Berlin as a city. Now living in London, you can really sort of, you can really see the kind of difference between the two cities, even though they're obviously both major European capitals. That sense of calmness, I think, at Berlin, and the feeling that it is large, but it's not completely crammed all in together, is such an amazing thing about the city. And just as a little aside, it's fantastic to me that the subway system is taken on trust. When you live in a place like London where there are barriers up to everything and nobody trusts anybody, the idea that you can just walk on the subway and walk off again, and, you know, the authorities, the powers that be, take it on trust that you will have bought your ticket, which incidentally I have, is kind of utopian in a really refreshing way. And it reminds me, I really must get my Spanish passport sorted out as quickly as possible. Right, folks, I shall be back tomorrow evening reporting on Saturday's goodies. Until then, see you later. Mm-hmm. Hello, everyone. Hope you're having a very good Saturday. It's 6 p.m. now in Berlin. I've just come back from my second screening. I've got another screening to come later on, which is, of course, Mark Jenkins' Bait. But I wanted to record my little summary after watching the two films that I've seen today particularly. I think that they kind of sit together really well. I'm going to be talking quite a bit about Bait with Neil at some stage when he gets over here, tomorrow night, in fact. I think these two films that I've seen today are really complementary to each other. They're both documentaries. They're both by and about female artists. They both explore the relationship between female identity, art, and life. I think it's interesting to talk about the way the forms of these documentaries actually feeds into the subject matter of the women that they are about, but also how different forms of art are captured through cinema and specifically through documentary. So the first film I saw was Kim Longinotto's Shooting the Mafia. So this documentary was nominally a portrait of the Italian photographer Letizia Battaglia. Now, I have to confess, I've never heard of her before, but right from the start, you can tell that this is somebody who is an incredible force of nature. The film is kind of constructed with three interwoven strands, and it's kind of chronological, but it does move backward and forward, especially in the kind of interview sections. So there's the life of the artist in a personal sense. So we see her growing up and then getting married, and then how she becomes a photographer and the relationships that she has throughout her life. And then we see in more detail how her career as a photographer defines and shapes that life. So in a sense, it really is clear that her vocation as a photographer is really central in how the artist defines herself and her kind of purpose, I suppose. And then the film kind of changes tack a little bit, maybe a third of the way in or halfway in, and focuses on what is perhaps her most important work, which is the focus on exposing, documenting, representing the atrocities of the mafia, both in terms of photographing them and representing how those atrocities were perpetrated directly, but also in terms of how the mafia affected the ordinary lives of the people, particularly of Palermo, and really Italian society more broadly. Now, you know, I really, really like this film a lot, and I think I don't want to talk too much about it because I think we're going to go into it in some detail, but just one thing to say. On the podcast, I think we've talked quite a lot about the ways in which documentary filmmakers seem to be inherently exploring the issues that the form throws up. The idea that documentary itself has to be challenged, the notion of the mechanically reproduced image as unproblematically correlating with the notion of truth is something that documentary filmmakers are starting to, well, not starting to, they've been doing it a long time, but I think are more and more, this sense that documentary form always comes from a position and it's shaping meaning as much as it is reflecting a kind of neutral verisimilitude. And I think that what's really great about this is it just shows the virtues of a really well-told classical documentary style. And Kim Longinotto obviously has got a really long history, a really experienced filmmaker, and you can really see the craft of the way that the images and sounds, and I'm talking about moving images and still photographs, and the voiceover and the score that is used for particular effects, and the way that the talking heads are put together. There's such a precise kind of symphony of editing here that really draws you in a fundamental way. And I think it kind of refrains from the flamboyance and verbosity of someone like Adam Curtis. A really profound piece of work, and I'm really looking forward to Neil's interview that's coming up with Kim, and also the chance to talk to him about it, because I think there's a lot more that can be said about this film. The second film I went to see was called Serendipity, and this was a film by the sculptor and artist Pruna Nuri. And this film sets itself up as a self-portrait. It moves more into being a kind of retrospective of the artist's work, but it's also quite impressionistic in terms of the way that the images are stitched together at certain times. There's much less of an attempt, I think, of exploring the meaning and the social context of the work I think purposely it tries not to shape the audience's viewpoint too much beyond the central thematics of the artist's work that's covered. Pruna Nuri is somebody I had heard of before, and the artist uses her own sort of self-processing of a diagnosis of breast cancer as a kind of framing mechanism to explore the themes that have run throughout her work. So it goes back to the early 2000s. It does kind of fit together well thematically, this notion of the body and reproduction and how those two things absolutely fundamentally underpin female identity. She's very interested in that, but also very specifically the medicalization process and how that process, its interrelationship with things like reproduction and the body, denaturalizes women. There's some really pretty shocking images or striking images at the beginning of a gynecological ultrasound. And then it moves on to her other work, which has a ironic and almost comedic tone. Things like the procreative dinner and the sperm bank really play on this kind of ironic need for human beings to kind of control nature, I think, and even right down to the desire to have the perfect kind of children. So as I say, the film is split into sections, and it moves forward into her other works. Holy Daughters and Terracotta Daughters show these absolutely fantastic major sculptures. They really do have a scale and size to them that is impressive. But more than that, you can see with her work that the craft meets the concept in a really powerful way. You know, sometimes when you're thinking about conceptual art, sometimes you can feel there is a lack of craft, or the artist is simply out to kind of shock and confuse just for the simple sake of it. But I think you can really sense how the artist really does have an intellectual and an emotional talent, which is matched by her material abilities as a sculptress and as a mixed media artist. And there's some really, you know, powerful, arresting images. I mean, there's this one moment where she's shaving her head, kind of preempting the chemotherapy that is about to kick in, and it's an extended sequence of her kind of shaving. And I don't know what it is, but I mean, again, maybe there's a sort of profound gender question here that needs to be explored about how a woman who's got, you know, really long, dark, thick hair, and you watch her shave it all off, it has this real, there's a real sort of sense of violence to that, which I found really affecting. And it's also kind of thought-provoking at the very end when she's actually preparing to have breast implants. There's a sort of unexplored, ambivalent sense of what the relationship is of this artist to her own body, and that she explores it and she contests it in lots of, you know, different and interesting ways. But then at the very end, it's kind of returning to this desire to want to have the kind of fully formed feminine body. Yeah, in the end, it was kind of really rewarding to watch these two films back to back. One of the other things I thought was interesting, that there was a cameo by Agnes Varda. They're obviously friends, her and Pruna. And it was interesting how, actually, that's what I was thinking about when I was watching Shooting the Mafia, about Letitia Battaglia. I thought she had the air of Agnes Varda about her. And I think that's the thing to take away from these two films. I found them both really inspiring. These two women were a real force of nature. And within that, their explorations of the self were really asking fundamental questions about what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a woman artist, and what their art can actually say about that. And not just a woman, what it means to be a creative person is something that I'm really thinking about more and more. And it just reminded me again that the relationship between whoever it is that is creating, whoever the artist is, and the work is just as important as a kind of cerebral distance objective viewpoint of whether you think something is good or bad. And that's what I thought about both of their works within the film, but both pieces of cinema itself. I was really happy to see both of them, and it almost seems kind of like churlish to sort of say, yeah, I recommend these films. Okay, so those are my thoughts for day two. I'm off to meet Mark Jenkin and watch his film Bait, so I will catch you later.
Nu är jag plötsligt säker. Lars är Lars. Även om jag sist såg honom 10 år gammal. Och jag är säker på att han inte kände igen mig.
Jag vet vem du är. I got something to be honest with.
Before we practiced light, I learned me mycket av honom. Visste hur saker och ting skulle göras.
Då såg du såg ut när jag var 15 år och du försvann i mitt liv.
So Neil, those were my thoughts for the first couple of days. I think one of the things that's just so gratifying is how you seem to serendipitously pick up loose connections between, or even in sort of obvious connections between different films that somehow they seem to, it seems to always happen. I don't know why at film festivals that I've always been to. And I think particularly, obviously that first afternoon or first morning afternoon when I saw the Kim Ong-Jonotto, the Shooting the Mafia, and then straight after the Pruno Nuri film. And I know it's interesting because some of the films that you wanted to see are about female filmmakers or artists.
Yeah, which is kind of mad, isn't it? Yeah. So three of the films that I'm really excited to see here are the Agnes Varda documentary, a film about PJ Harvey, and Joanna Hogg's The Souvenir, which is an autobiographical kind of take on her life as a kind of film student and then kind of young filmmaker. So
yeah.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Like with the big festivals, the coverage, more and more, particularly in podcasts, I think, because people are having a conversation about it, stems towards what are the themes, you know, taking the temperature of the culture. You know, when you get this many films in a place, are there common themes? Are filmmakers all around the world all gathered around certain ideas, you know, like, and looking at, well, kind of after 9/11, what were the films like then?
Sure.
You know, after the recession in 2008, what is the kind of response to these things? And it almost feels like there is a response in terms of, not Me Too, because a lot of these films have been in development for a long time, but certainly an emergence of kind of female artists at the fore and a kind of, you know, taken seriously cinematically in the same way that kind of male artists have been in a real breadth of really interesting and kind of formally interesting different kind of films, at least from the outside.
Yeah, and it also looks as if these kinds of films are also trying to wed together the form and the concept, you know, in really interesting kinds of ways, rather than just simply focusing on the kind of canonical position of the person, because it's almost as if they're trying to be outside of placing those hierarchies.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, where does Joanna Hogg sit in relationship to Agnes Varda or whoever? Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, it doesn't seem to be about that, which is part of, I think, of the ideology of feminism, really, if I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, that particularly kind of second wave feminism in terms of, you know, the political and social context within which women are operating in terms of labour and art and things like that. I think, yeah, it feels externally, certainly like these films, and I've seen Shooting the Mafia as well. I saw it before I came. And interesting, I was reading the Val Wilmer book that you bought me on Black, on Free Jazz and Black Power. And very much the same as well, looking at like black art, but certainly like never devoid of its political and social context, always understanding that, you know, there are other things at play other than, like you said, and it is a kind of true generalization, I think, that often the male artist is separated from that and almost above it in terms of how the portrayal is, like they are just separate from what the world is, what's going on in the world. Whereas Shooting the Mafia was definitely this is an artist who is deeply embedded in the politics of daily life.
Yeah, and also that there isn't so much of a sense in which the male artists are continuously self-reflexively, like positioning themselves and who they are and how their art is shaping them. It's almost kind of more implicit, I suppose, it has been traditionally sort of taken for granted that men just do the art and they don't have to kind of worry. Whereas, you know, particularly I think in Shooting the Mafia, you know, the whole first section, and I have to say, you know, watching that film, it's great that you've seen it and we can get to discuss it now. The sort of, I mean, to be honest, the first two thirds, I thought that this is an absolute masterpiece. I mean, the whole thing is just brilliant. It's worth watching. But particularly when it focuses on Letizia Battaglia's formative years and then how her photography, the way it kind of matches up her photography with her identity, but then how her particular kind of style and eye captures these sort of moments of trauma, I think. That's the way I sort of wrote it down. She seemed to have this absolute talent for being absolutely at the moment where the trauma can be most realised, I suppose, in the still image.
Yeah, quite extraordinary. An ability to capture it visually that was matched by her understanding of it, which was just kind of remarkable, like how eloquent she was and how poetic she was in kind of capturing it in really kind of beautiful language what she was doing, you know, really understanding the complexities of what she was doing. And, you know, I know she shied away from saying that they were beautiful images, but that was a great
moment, because she actually said, I wish I could deny the beauty in the images of the horror, which is so, you know, I mean, that is the big question, isn't it, about whether it's moving images or still images. Do they automatically glamorize whatever it is that is in front of the camera?
And I think what was interesting was like the way Kim Longinotto used archive film.
Yeah.
It was just a fantastic kind of engagement with the iconography of the mafia and how they've been. You kind of think, well, if this is the reality of this archive, which is insane access and, you know, this amazing material in terms of a kind of document, you realize what the Godfather's doing. I'm going to speak to Kim while I'm here, and she's been on the podcast before as well, which kind of listeners will know, and really excited just to talk about how it all came together and whether that was a conscious thing. I thought it was really brave that a film, a moving image film, spent so much time basically saying, look how great still, you know, how much more powerful still film is. You know, it's kind of really, really brave for a film to take that position.
Yeah.
You know,
but also it was so brilliantly edited. I'm not just talking about the kind of edit of the image next to, like, the still images. This one moment where you can see the TV images of the, like, dead people in the car, and then you cut to the still image that she'd taken. It just showed the sort of different effects of the almost sort of different perspective on truth that different textures of images give, which is really fascinating. But it's almost kind of like a symphony of editing, I found it, you know what I mean? So there's moving images, but then there's moving images of different textures. There's the still images, there's the talking heads, which is obviously the stuff that Kim had shot. Then there's the talking heads that was used as voiceover, and then there's the music that was used to kind of emphasize certain moments. It was absolutely
brilliant.
There
was talking heads of Battaglia earlier
on.
You know, so
at different times as
well.
Yeah,
lots of different times. So you got this kind of amazing, the amazing layers of her life through the moving image. Yeah, and just I can see why Kim kind of made that Kim, you know. I can see
our
why
friend Kim.
Our friend Kim. I can see why Kim Longinotto made that decision towards the end, because I think that the body of work that she had access to and the way she kind of sets it up was extraordinary. But and also because I think that, like you say, the first two thirds, the balancing act between how the film kind of manages to convey her individual life.
Yeah.
The art of photography as seen through this practitioner and the history of the mafia in this place and is kind of extraordinary that it feels so tightly connected.
But it just to say to listeners, what happens in the second third is it goes much more clearly into almost a sort of historical piece about the mafia and about their, you know, through the 70s, 80s and 90s when they were being investigated. And what's really interesting is that Letitia, the photographer, it's less about her photography in the second half and more about she moves into politics. And, you know, it's clearly, it's like this force of nature. It's amazing how, you know, she really does sort of, there's echoes of Agnes Varda in her, clearly, you know what I mean? And it's an interesting choice, if that's what it is. But I think, I mean, I've read a couple of criticisms of the film that's saying that the focus on her is lost, on the photographer is lost, and it becomes more conventional. But I can see why that's happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's definitely, you can see the choice, and I think it is, I think people will either like it or they won't, but I just think the first half is so remarkable, the first two-thirds are so remarkable that I just forgave it, and then, just the kind of the poignancy at the end, you know, and what I kind of felt was, you realise the cost of that way of life in that place, and it just took a toll.
Oh, God,
that I don't think even she realises. No, I think she talks about the decisions that she made and love and romance and things like that. But I think that the sheer complex world, it just ripped everybody's lives apart to the point that I think that even they're not kind of aware of of just how they were affected, or, you know, the ways they were affected, which was just stunning.
And another interesting choice about the first half was her decision to sort of use old Italian movie
footage
to kind of convey the relationship she was having. Like, she got married very early, but then sort of fell in love with this guy, you know, who is in the movie as well. That's really fascinating that you know, she brings these two great loves of Letitia, the two men, into the documentary. And they have these conversations on camera about how do you feel about me now and all this kind of, which is absolutely fascinating stuff.
Yeah, amazing. The film history stuff just, like, again, representations of place, representations of, you know, the Corleone region, and set against her representations through kind of these documentary photographs.
Yeah, it's just...
just like, and yeah, just kind of the meaning and the feeling that was kind of, brought up when you, because again, it's looking at the photos with her context reframes how you look at those photos.
Yeah.
And then watching those films in the context of now understanding how they're part of this wider, very murky political kind of, again, reframes how you, I mean, just a real act of kind of research.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that. They don't give awards out for research.
It's just amazing.
It's video essayistic, really, you know, is the film. But really entertaining at the same time.
Yeah, so just amazing. Like, and again, because you've got this woman at the centre who's just an incredible human being, you know.
Yeah.
Bold, brave, what's the word? Unapologetic about some of the stuff that she's done in her personal life.
Yeah,
you know, just like, but it's all bound up in this amazing art and amazing life. It's really extraordinary piece of work. So thanks to Kim for letting me see it early, because I would have missed the earlier screenings.
I'm just so glad I managed to get a ticket for it. So I think what we're going to do now is I'm going to talk a little bit about the films I've seen today as my day three summary. So Neil, feel free to chip in and ask me questions as we go along.
Exciting. I don't really know what's coming now. So
I had three films lined up, and then I got a ticket late on for an early morning showing. The first film I saw was called Out Stealing Horses by Hans-Petter Moland, who is a director I've never heard of, and I hadn't seen any of his films before, to be perfectly honest. But Norwegian filmmaker and a really sort of epic literary drama, ambitious, absolutely beautiful, shot amazingly, and Stellan Skarsgård in the lead. He plays a character called Trond, and it's the story of his kind of formative years, particularly his relationship with his father. And he's now an old man, and then suddenly we get these flashbacks. I mean, particularly around this summer that he's out in the forests logging. It's a really, like I say, it's really beautifully shot, a really handsome film. It has this sort of Western feel to it. And again, it's kind of like a lot of stuff we've seen before about the father-son relationship, you know, sort of rites of passage type of stuff. This is one scene where the son is sort of weeding the nettles around the thing, and he doesn't want to get stung. And the father just wades in with the arms and says, you know, like, pain is a state of mind. And it's all this kind of like how to become a man and this kind of stuff. It's based on a novel, and you can see it has a sort of really literary background, but the director, I think, tries really hard to pull it out of being a straight literary adaptation, both with the time jump, so it sort of moves back over four different time periods, and then also there's a lot of almost kind of quick jump cuts to kind of images of nature, so it's really doing that kind of men in nature type stuff. And it manages the structural complexity quite well, so it sort of, you always know where you are. However, it's one of those films where you kind of like, you feel like that the flashback from Skarsgård, so it goes backward and forward to him, and they're trying to get into his inner psychology, but it never really becomes personal on that level. But it never really sort of escapes its literary background, I don't think. Okay. But it grew on me as we went along. As soon as I accepted, you know, sometimes when you've got a big sprawling epic, things happen and you almost say to yourself, oh, that's a bit abrupt now. We've gone on to this bit and we've gone on to that bit. And it's almost kind of like, oh, well, I wanted more depth to the characterization or the story in a more focused way.
You kind of do find that with adaptations, don't you? Where like knowing what to do. And sometimes they can feel a bit formulaic in terms of the way they've been translated. So it is kind of chapters and like we've got to kind of pack as much as much story in rather than kind of maybe, yeah, kind of spending time really drilling down into something that's interesting rather than...
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it never fully succeeds, I don't think, in reaching the complexity of the characterization and what the individual emotions and feel. You know, it's almost kind of like you feel that, you know, it's big production values. That looks absolutely fantastic. But underneath it all, the kind of... the theme is really not that, yeah, there's not that much depth to it really, yeah, at the end of the day. I can imagine it's a really good novel. I bet it is, really, you know, because you get a sense that inner stream of consciousness and psychology of the characters obviously can kind of be explored in more time.
Yeah.
Whereas here, the director is obviously trying to pack it all in, and I would imagine he's trying to be quite faithful to the novel, but that's quite difficult if it is a big epic.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, like, it's hard, I suppose, when someone like Malick has done that interior kind of, well, man in nature, and been able to kind of find a cinematic way of doing that. Mm. You know, that is kind of the way. And I've not seen many others that...
Yeah, because it's much more conventional than
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah. You know? And it's how to get that interior idea onto the screen in a way that's not just,
kind of... And it's like, even with all the kind of aesthetic, you know, I don't want to say tricks, but the directorial hand that is on the movie, which is definitely there, it's still nowhere near as good as Cold War, for example.
It
just strips everything back and still manages to be massively epic.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I say, it grew on me. I can imagine actually it's going to be quite popular with festival audiences, that film.
Cool. Well, I might win a Scuba Cold War. What else have we seen?
So after that, I saw Light of My Life, which is Casey Affleck's first fictional film, which is written and directed.
Some might say I'm Still Here is a fictional film.
Well, indeed. Well, I don't want to, I'm not going to get into a generic argument, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So this is about a father bringing up his daughter in a kind of rural wilderness setting. So suddenly, you know, very, very quickly, it really has echoes of Leave No Trace. Mm. You know, it's the first thing I thought of. But in the first sort of scenes, you get these little clues as to all's not what it seems in terms of the kind of social and the world that they're living in. For example, I mean, the obvious first clue is that this is the daughter is actually posing as a boy. And you realise pretty quickly that they are living in this kind of post-apocalyptic or dystopian America. And it's one of the good things about the film is that he doesn't over-explain that. There are little clues here and there, which I like that when a sci-fi or a dystopian movie doesn't over-explain. Because I always feel like films fall into traps then that doesn't work and this doesn't work. It doesn't give you too many clues, but it's like this survivalist narrative.
Okay, yeah.
So you get then echoes of things like The Road and then even Children of Men, because the pandemic affects women. It's about... Again, it's not completely clear, but it's this disease that has affected women. So there's only few women around. And as they're going through, you hear little clues that there are communes about, that there are women there. So he's trying to stop anybody finding out that his daughter is a girl, essentially. And like I say, it does have these echoes of other films that I've seen before, but it's slightly churlish for me to say it's like wholly derivative in the way that, you know, most films are derivative in some way, aren't they? And I think it's really, really well acted. I mean, it's an actor's piece, and you can tell that in the writing that he's written it in a way in which the relationship between the father and the daughter, you know, like coming to... they're in this library, this dilapidated library, and he starts reading parenting manuals. You know what I mean? And it's the end of the world all happening around him. He's still trying to figure out the best way to raise his daughter. It's kind of interesting stuff like that. Again, there's flashbacks in this movie as well. So Elizabeth Moss pops up. Interestingly, who seems to be the kind of like generic Earth mother in every single movie or TV show. Can't even think of The Handmaid's Tale. But she you know, we go back to little moments of her and the daughter never knew her and this kind of stuff. So it sets that up quite well. There's a lot of stuff that you've seen before, but it's kind of satisfyingly solid because of the writing, because of the acting. There is this sort of dread that you do get throughout the movie where you sort of sense that something is going to go, you know, really bad at some point. And when the violence comes, it's aptly messy and guttural level, you know, it's not nice to watch.
Yeah.
I mean, not something that's unique or we haven't seen before, but good, I thought.
Cool, great.
Nice.
I don't know if you'd heard. Have you?
Yeah,
have
no,
you heard anything about that? Or?
I've kind of not really. Yeah, I've not really read reviews that have come out. I've tried to avoid because.
Right. No worries.
No, I mean, your reviews are great. but you know, but yeah, just trying to. I think as well, because having the access that I might have, you know, in terms of the press thing, it's like kind of trying to be able to. And not having to file review after review after review, kind of, it's a freedom to just try, you know, to just see what's on when and kind of pick stuff up, which is how I like to do things. And I don't really like, you know, I don't really like to see reviews.
No, no, I know what you mean.
You know, in advance anyway, particularly I think at like a big festival where you can just see people are trying to get the first review out.
Yeah,
you know?
That's
why it was nice about Bait, because I think Bait playing in the forum, it meant the reviews were a bit more measured. It's not in the main competition in terms of like, we've got to get this out because everyone needs to know now, and it sometimes leads to just trying to have a hot take.
Sure.
And I think the Casey Affleck thing probably means there's probably a lot of takes out there that are just more about that than the film.
Maybe. Yeah, I think, I mean, that is the one thing. I mean, one thing I would say about the fact that he's the writer-director, I mean, it's always interesting when a star, an actor, goes into directing, and we have the whole thing with Bradley Cooper who's gone that way. You know, the big production values, it's making
the
mistake. Whereas Affleck, I think, has gone, you know, he's going back to the sort of trying to stick within this sort of very indie, low key sensibility. And it's a really stripped back piece of work, you know what I mean?
Well, maybe that's the, you know, because, you know, the Bradley Cooper thing's interesting in terms of like, he sees Clint Eastwood as a mentor and as a kind of figure. And maybe Affleck thinks like Dave Lowry and Kenneth Lonergan, he's had a long relationship with. He's like, okay, this is. Which often means that some of the first films feel very much rooted in kind of that almost bridge from.
Yeah, and
from
it's interesting as well with this film. I think that, like, is this part now of a cycle of films? I don't want to call them post-Trump, but a sort of interrogating that idea of end times.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Obviously, it's with it being dystopian, it's doing it more directly, but that sense of working class American lives at the point in which America may not be the same as it has been, for the last however many years.
Yeah, we did mention that in the end of the year show, didn't we? In terms of like Leave No Trace and things
interesting. So, last couple of films very quickly. I saw a documentary called System K, which follows a group of street artists in Kinshasa, and it's contextualized in terms of the sort of crippling poverty of that city and lack of infrastructure. And the fact that, ironically, for want of a better word, it's a city and an area that is absolutely rich in natural resources. So these contradictions are inherent in these artists who are making art literally out of nothing. So the film's trying to reflect on the sort of talent and vibe and violence and urgency that's spawning this art that's right on the cutting edge. I mean, it's not even... art in the sense that you could call it art from a Western perspective. I mean, I wouldn't say that like a Western artist. I mean, again, it's being general, but the idea that art is a sort of matter of life and death is really true here. Mm. It's like they're using it to in one sense to kind of get by, but to reject and resist the poverty that is, you know, all around them. And it's so interesting how the city is absolutely teeming with life, but they're, you know, really interesting ways in which that these artists are expressing themselves. Like one of the guys was sort of, is using empty bullet casings to create these amazing sculptures and sort of makes this house out of machetes, which is the machetes which all the gangsters use and this kind of stuff. And then there's this other artist who, she burns canvases and then she sort of hangs them upside down and then on top of a fire, and so they're all smoke laden, and then cuts in the image into the smoke that's left. So and makes the images as kind of skulls and death that comes out of these sort of fire burnt canvases. Really interesting. And then the zenith of it are these artists that use their bodies, sort of performance artists, to the real sort of extreme level. And the denouement at the end is this performance artist who does this piece called Bloodbath, which is literally they sacrifice animals and then, you know, store all of the blood, and he starts pouring it on himself and starts walking through the street. So it really is sort of trying to show these artists at the absolute cutting edge of art as a kind of political act of resistance, you know, and a lot of people kind of walked out towards the end because they just couldn't take the sight of this blood. And it was an observational doc, again, trying not to, you know, very clearly trying not to impose a sort of worldview on what's going on. And it just gave a very, very quick intertitle of the name of the artist, one after another, and then and sort of followed their performance or making of their art and with a little bit of talking heads.
Cool, that sounds great.
Yeah, really interesting, and that kind of film that's what you want to be seeing at a festival. And yeah, if you get a chance to see that, it'd be worth.
Yeah, no, that sounds.
There's a lot of the music in it is really interesting.
Cool.
As well,
so yeah, that sounds something that we've got on my street.
And lastly, the last thing I want to say, I'm just going to say one line on this, was a film called The Ground Beneath My Feet, The Boden unter den Flügeln, which is in competition. So that the two films in competition was the Austrian film I said at the beginning, and this one. And this was just a really highly forgettable psychological drama. I found it kind of both narratively bland and inconsistent, which is kind of an interesting feat to get to, really. It plays on sort of elements of Scandi noir, but there's little in the way of drama and little in the way of psychological depth or kind of like schlock value that you might get from a sort of, you know, a Brian De Palma movie. Yeah, just avoid that. Don't bother with it.
Okay.
That's all I would say.
Cool. I wasn't on my list. I'll make sure it's got a big red mark next to it.
Cool. Well, I feel like I've gone off on one now.
That was good.
We better come to the end of our handover. But maybe you could just give a quick preface of what's to come in the second half.
So, I'm going to go to sleep. And then tomorrow I'm interviewing some filmmakers who made a film called Barakoa, which is a kind of really strange performative documentary about two boys in a Cuban village. So that kind of kicks off my activities. What you'll hear, hopefully, is a kind of series of kind of mini reviews by me, similar to the ones that you've done, kind of catching up with the films that I've seen, and then trying to talk to as many people as possible about what they've seen. So I have lined up some interviews with some critics and also seeing some friends. There's a filmmaker here who's not got a film at the festival, but she's covering it for German television. But she made, I don't know if I told you about this film about the Sleaford Mods. So she lives in Berlin. I'm going to see her.
A bunch of kunst.
Yeah. Which I love.
Well made.
Indeed. So she lives in Berlin. So I'm going to see her because she's here covering the festival. Yeah, I've got a couple of critics I'm going to see, new and old. Just see what it's all about, really, get a sense of it. I am very excited about picking up my pass and obviously I've seen Bait. Did you see me on the big screen?
Trying not to look into the camera, I thought.
Well, you know, it's hard when there's someone telling you not to look in the camera. He's a good director, Mark.
Directing 101, don't look into the camera.
So that was a small bathroom. Spoiler alert, I'm in the toilet. So I'm going to see that, and then we'll probably talk about when we do our wrap up. I'm going to try and catch Mark for a chat. That's my plan, really. Enjoy the festival and see as many films as I can. Talk to some people, enjoy some street food, and do the.
Brilliant. So what time is it now? 2:30 in the morning. I better let you go to bed.
Yeah, 25 to 3.
And we'll catch up at the end of the podcast.
Yeah, this has been great. Really, amazing. I'm so pleased that you could come out. I think it's been really cool.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Great. So part one done. See you on the other side.